What I wanted to do today is to lead you through the mic. What I wanted to do was to present some of the issues that we confronted from the worker perspective. Just one disclaimer, I don't work for the Occupational Safety and Health Administration, so this is not an OSHA presentation, but OSHA is our partner in many ways. So what I wanted to do was to start off with the event that happened on the 20th of April, which I think we're all aware of, in which 11 workers lost their lives, 17 others were injured out of a crew of 126. One fact that that has been reported that I think is interesting and relates to how we judge whether any industrial activity is safe or not. At the time that the blowout occurred, four BP and Transocean executives were on the platform actually giving a safety award at that time. And it really heightens the issue about how you really measure whether a project is safe or not. The issue of jurisdiction was a serious one, and I won't dwell on that other than to say that for OSHA jurisdiction beyond the 3-mile territorial limit is an issue. This obviously is what happened after the event. The Gulf of Mexico is a very large workplace, if you will. It's a 600,000 square mile workplace. And what we concentrated on was a small area of that workplace, which is depicted here in some of the diagrams that we used from the Incident Command Center. What I wanted to point out, though, as a workplace, one of the things that that we focus on is the exposure to workers. This was, if you will, a well-ventilated workplace in many ways, since it was outdoors. There were lots of occupational hazards in the Gulf response, and I wanted to list a few of those that we listed on our website. Some of these are pretty obvious, related to cardiovascular disease, heat stress, traumatic injury, fatigue, chemical issues, either with crude oil, the dispersant or others, particulates, odor threshold issues. But there were also issues related to musculoskeletal injuries. You know, when you put 50, 60, 70,000 people in a small area, lots of machinery going back and forth, lots of lifting, all those kinds of things were not really reported well, but they actually resulted in a significant amount of exposure to workers. Cuts and scratches from wildlife cleanup and decontamination, environmental exposures due to UV being outdoors, lightning strikes even during storms, a lot of motor vehicle accidents because machinery was moving back and forth, insect bites, noise, and other things. A lot of these things were not reported in the media. Probably the most important thing that we did with our partners at OSHA was to develop a joint guidance for workers and volunteers to protect them from occupational issues. This marked the first time in the 40-year history of the Occupational Safety and Health Act that the two agencies came together and issued the same set of guidelines. In that set of guidelines, we had a lot of stuff in there. One area that I wanted to concentrate on amongst about three or four that I want to tell you about this morning is the pre-placement issues that we, recommendations that we made to BP and its contractors that were working to bring these tens of thousands of just-in-time workers, if you will, to the site. I think we could have done it faster, and I think one issue in the future for as we get to looking at long-term physical effects of disasters is whether or not we want to expand this pre-placement evaluation to include testing or blood sampling. The other issue, which was the big issue for workers during the Gulf, was the heat stress issue, with heat indices sometimes in the 100, 110 range. In the guidance document, we had some guidance for folks in terms of pre-placement evaluation, as well as looking at injuries as they were occurring, heat stress injuries. So the guidance, I think, was good in that respect. We also tackled this issue about fatigue. You know, oftentimes it's a big rush to, in an emergency recovery effort, to get things done quickly, and workers are often pressed by their employers to work very long hours, and there's a sort of a forgetfulness about the biological organism needing rest. And this is an area that there are no occupational standards for. There is a lot of guidance and recommendations. But in the guidance document from the NIOSH side, we actually put some more concrete examples about fatigue issues that OSHA was then able to talk to the contractors about. One issue is which is even more difficult to get your hands around, is this resiliency issue, or the psychological stress associated with working in a recovery operation. And indeed, we did have a lot of success in getting some of these essential pillars of worker resiliency added to the stress document and worked with the BP's contractors on. One of the things that we learned from our experience at the World Trade Center is we did not have a roster of individuals who participated in the event. Even federal agencies failed to keep track of that, and 9 years later, we're still trying to identify people who were involved in the event. So what we did not want to happen with the Deepwater Horizon event is we wanted to know who was participating. So we began to roster workers, a collection of basic demographic information. This rostering occurred somewhat after the initial workers were already on site. And so as you can see here from this slide, we went around to the staging areas to actually interface with workers, and we were able to roster about 16,000 folks that had already left a training center, an NEIHS-sponsored training center. But most of the rostering occurred, about 40,000 workers, at the training center. So our total roster is nearly 56,000 individuals. This was an enormous effort on our part, utilizing some 250 NIOSH folks who rotated in and out of the Gulf area. Just a little demographic breakdown of these worker rosters of this total 55,000. Most of them were male. Most of them were Caucasian, non-Hispanic. Most of them were BP staff or staff of the contractors, volunteers, especially in wildlife decontamination, many federal workers, state and local workers. All of them are included in the roster. I wanted to point out, for researchers, we have made the roster available to any researcher who's interested in using the roster to recruit workers from that. It's a very easy procedure to follow. It's on our website. I've just outlined here in this slide to send us an email, and we'll work with you to get access to the roster. I wanted to talk about our exposure assessment for a moment here. In this particular area, this large 600,000 square mile workplace, if you will, we divided our world into on the water and on the land. So on the water, we had folks working at the source, where the Macondo well was 5,000 feet below the surface of the Gulf. Folks also away from the source engaged in burning fresh oil that contained a large amount of volatiles capable of actually combustion. And then folks closer to the shore, but still on the water, that were laying boom and skimming oil in collecting it to take it off of the surface of the water. And then we had three exposure scenarios on land. One was folks that you saw on the TV most often, folks that were cleaning the beach. And then we had folks obviously engaged in wildlife cleanup or in machinery decontamination. So those were our six exposure thresholds. Just to go through some of that so that you'll know, this is a picture, obviously, the source, which many of you saw on TV, with methane being flamed, the highly volatile methane being flamed, as well as the oil coming up from the in the water column at that particular site. At the source. So we engaged in air sampling, a personal monitor sample, which I'll show you in those results, and just some pictures of the in situ burning, which occurred on the on the Gulf, where we had vessels of opportunity, private sea captains who were normally fishermen, who would use their boats to lay boom to capture as much highly volatile fresh oil as possible, and then to combust that oil in these fairly dramatic fashion here. You can see here the distance that's maintained between the vessel of opportunity and these pyres of fresh oil. Near shore or in the immediate offshore environment, a number of activities occurred, this booming and skimming being an example here shown in these photos, where oil was tried to be collected so it would not impact the wildlife on the beach or the marshes. As I say, most of the pictures that you probably saw on TV where camera crews could get easily to that were folks that were engaged in beach cleanup, taking tar paddies, other things off the beach, sifting through the sand, looking for this highly weathered crude that looks more like asphalt than it does crude here pictured in this slide. A lot of issues had to do with collecting the oil and then vacuuming the barges for that oil. And then lastly, a highly exposed environment, our workers here you can see in respirators and face masks and suits and all that, that actually were washing vessels so that they could remove the oil under high pressure hoses. For some of you familiar with oil cleanup from the Exxon Valdez, high pressure hoses were used to clean the rocks along the Alaska coast. The coastline of the Gulf is very different, so high pressure hoses were not used on the shoreline, but they were used to clean equipment here, which obviously aerosolizes a lot of stuff. So I want to go over just briefly with you some of the data with regard to the 2,577 air sample points that we collected. 33% of them were personal breathing zone samples, and 67% were general air samples. The individuals whose personal breathing zone samples were conducted, about 16 individuals, 15 vessels, and two different ports. And as we'll see, we only had one of the 840 personal breathing samples that exceeded any occupational exposure limit. And the word any here means any planetary, our planet, occupational exposure limit. And as we all know, there are limitations to OSHA exposure limits. And I want to just go over a few of these issues in some detail. We looked at 110 different chemical analytes in our process, and here is a very complicated slide just to show you that what we compared is any occupational exposure limit on the planet. OSHA permissible exposure limits are out of date and obsolete, and many of them really shouldn't be used. So what we used are any one that we could find regardless of the country of origin. And as you see here, outlined in yellow is our carbon monoxide exceeding our own U.S. standard. So let's just go into some detail here on onshore exposure monitoring. This is 261 sampling points. 59 of those samples were non-detect samples. 23% were less than minimum quantifiable concentration, which is defined by people smarter than I as samples less than the concentration of uncertainty associated with the samples. None of these individuals' chemical exposures exceeded any of the OELs that I've mentioned, and except for we had a noise issue at one point. On the offshore exposure samples, we did get one individual's exposure to carbon monoxide, which exceeded our own recommended exposure limit of 200 parts per million. This occurred at an in-situ burn site. This is a vessel that was stationary. The motor was idling. Anyone who's ever been on a fishing boat or any vessel knows that there is diesel fuel that's burned, et cetera. So we think that it was engine exhaust that was primarily responsible. When we looked at injury and illness data, which we did not collect ourselves, since this is the responsibility of employers at the site, BP, Coast Guard, all the contractors, what we did do is try to corral it into some kind of sensible story. We have a lot of data that we looked at on OSHA recordables, first aid studies, and I don't want to bore you with all of that, just to show you some examples of that where we looked at this by week in order to be able to produce that information to the incident command so that we could say, oh, that we got a problem over here, we have a problem over here, we need to make some changes. One issue that was not really reported well by the media, but it plagued us every day, and that had to do with the issues of heat stress. And this is a slide that tries to illustrate in the red the ambient temperatures as well as the incidence of heat stress reporting, dehydration, fainting, et cetera. And they seem to correlate well in terms of that. So as we approached warmer days, the fatigue, the work rest cycle was changed. So at one point, we had workers working only 15 minutes out of the hour and resting 45 minutes out of the hour. Of course, that produced some degree of concern on the part of folks who thought that workers weren't working enough and that they were really, the federal government wasn't doing a good enough job getting this recovery fast enough. So, but it was based on sound information. I just wanted to briefly talk about some of the issues that are related to the chemicals involved, especially crude and all of this issue about dispersants. Crude oil, as we all know, is a mixture. It's a chemical mixture made up of a whole bunch of things. Certainly short chain hydrocarbon chains and rings, some very volatile, some not so volatile, trace metals, et cetera. And lots of health effects have been described from exposure to crude oil, involving both acute and longer-term health effects. But the longer-term health effects, if you look in the literature, really aren't terribly well described. Certainly this issue about genotoxicity is still an open question. Whether there are persistent respiratory and or CNS effects is somewhat an issue. And the carcinogenicity. If you look in the IR carcinogen classification for crude oil, it's unclassifiable. So there's a bit of concern with regard to long-term health effects. And this is from our guidance. What we did was we looked at all previous studies of oil spills, and primarily these are tanker spills. These are not totally equivalent to what we experience in the Gulf where you have a well that's actually producing in an uncontrolled fashion. So these are mostly tankers. And you'd be surprised, at least I was very surprised, how often on the planet that these tankers are running aground or hitting rocks and spilling certain amounts of oil. So I think we're all familiar with the Exxon Valdez event. Not much was done after that in terms of chronic health studies. There was a significant amount of litigation that made things very difficult for researchers in that area. But as you can see here, a number of crude oil spills or fuel oil spills or other oil spills have occurred all over the globe. And if you look through this list and even to the Prestige oil tanker spill in Spain, which is probably the most well-studied, researchers are still looking at that cohort of people in terms of chronic health effects. That's probably the best cohort study. You really don't see a robust medical literature on chronic health effects. Hence, the National Institute of Health is looking at a study for longer-term health effects and physical health effects. I wanted to talk about this issue of dispersants just a bit because it is a significant public policy issue. It is an issue of environmental control, if you will, and remediation that impacts occupational health. The issue about dispersants, and I encourage you to look at the National Academy's review of dispersants that I have referenced. It essentially, the purpose is to enhance the amount of oil that physically mixes with the water column, thereby reducing the risk that oil will contaminate the shoreline and eventually having deleterious effects on fish and birds and all the sea mammals. It obviously increases the exposure of the water column and the benthic or the lower level organisms to spilled oil. And basically, it represents that trade-off. Between increasing the hydrocarbon load on the water column while reducing it on the coastal wetland. So it clearly is a trade-off, and environmental specialists and others are going to have to work out whether this continues to be the public policy response to oil spills. In terms of their chemical actions, they're essentially like a detergent. And they break up oil into smaller droplets so they can mix with the water column. They have like detergents, they have a water end of their chemical and then a fatty end so that they can mix with the water better. And I just wanted to point out that essentially they are yet another hydrocarbon mixture, if you will. This is a sample of what's in Corexit 9500A, which is the most commonly used dispersant. About a million pounds of it was used in the Gulf. Basically, it's a bunch of petroleum distillates. It has some sorbitans in it. 2-butoxyethanol was the ingredient that produced the most concern. It is a hemolytic agent. It causes kidney and liver toxicity. It's found in the Corexit 9527, which is another Nalco product in a little higher concentration than it is in the 9500A. It was used briefly, that higher concentration, in May. The EPA took great exception to that, and that was stopped. And most of it was the 9500A. This is just some pictures of the three mechanisms by which the dispersant was applied, by either aerial, which we on the occupational health community thought was a bit much, especially if workers were underneath the aerial spraying. It's like being underneath a crop duster. So we made sure that workers were not in the area of spraying, or they were in their wheelhouses at the time. The middle picture is the subsurface application where the dispersant was applied as the crude oil came up in the water column right at the source. And then the third, which probably had the most occupational exposure potential, had to do with fitting a fishing vessel with tubes that went out over the side of the vessel, as you can see here, with little sprayers close to the water. It certainly produces the spray close to the source as opposed to the aerial spraying. When this was applied, workers were in the wheelhouse when the nozzle went on so that they would not be exposed to the dispersant. We obtained samples of the dispersant as well as samples of the unadulterated crude oil, and we are doing toxicity research in this area on the dispersant that was used, doing some acute animal testing, some inhalational studies, and also determining sensitization thresholds for both of these crude oil as well as the dispersant. We hope to have abstracts for these studies out by the end of the year or the beginning of next year. I wanted to just leave you with some discussion, as all of us that participated in this and the rest of the panelists will certainly comment on this, is, you know, what lessons have we learned from this event? We often do simulated events in which we do tabletop exercises, and we have lessons learned from that. But this is a real event, and I think all of us need to reflect on this very seriously. I wanted to just frame it just briefly for you. We all responded, if you will, according to the National Contingency Plan, which is the federal government's blueprint for responding to both oil spills as well as hazardous substance releases. It was first developed in the 60s after the Torrey Canyon spill off the English coast. Congress has changed a number of times in the Clean Water Act in 72, as Administrator Jackson referred to. Passage of Superfund changed, and the most recent change to the National Contingency Plan was made in the mid-90s with the Oil Pollution Act of 1990, which changed the contingency plan. So I just want to offer a few little observations. They're in no way anything but mine, but we're reflecting on all of these things, as we should. The National Contingency Plan, in my estimation, lacked a robust and coordinated plans for really integrating public health needs, and I include occupational as well as community public health needs, and support at the earliest opportunity in the event. You know, we in the occupational community have to sort of be obnoxious and insert ourselves into things. It should be in the plan. The second point, you know, independent engagement by OSHA is sort of a subcategory of trying to insert yourself, is very limited. It's missing in the plan. The occupational safety and health aspect is really an annex. It's not really a primary function for both onshore, a FEMA event, as well as this oil spill offshore event. Lots of, I think, work we could do on coordinating our risk communications, our public health information. Certainly at CDC, we tried to do that with wonderful partners in both Louisiana and, as you know, here in Alabama on our panel, and Mississippi and Florida. But those needs, I think, in terms of the assessments that needed to be done, weren't well addressed in the earliest stages of the event by the Unified Command. They were very busy with lots of other things, but that needed to be done. And I think our own interim worker guidance took a while. As the person who held 19 drafts in my possession, we tried to work as fast as we could. I think we could have worked faster in getting that guidance out. Our own world of OSHA and NIOSH, we lacked our own seat at the incident command table, and I think the next response, we need to have our own chair there. The reimbursement issues were very complicated in this area. As you know, President Obama made it very clear that the American taxpayer would not bear the burden for this event. Essentially, BP would. And so reimbursement, this was new for us because under a FEMA event, it's very clear the money comes from FEMA. Reimbursement issues, working with the Coast Guard to charge certain things to the Coast Guard, travel, hotels, et cetera. This was something we had to work very fast, and we were somewhat unclear in the beginning. I think it slowed our response in the occupational area. As you know, we don't have a national surveillance system for occupational issues, so we have to knit one together, if you will, every time we do one of these things. And certainly, you know, from the federal government, we ourselves, our own agencies, didn't have, I think, all of our act together in terms of pre-emptive deployment screening and resiliency support. So these are just some of the issues that are occurring. I urge you, if you're a student of this area, there's lots of literature in this area. And if any of you have any questions for me now or at any time in the future, my email address is jhoward1@cdc.gov. Please send me an email. I'd be happy to get you in touch with the right expert in NIOSH who may know an answer to your question. So thank you very much. I'd be happy to answer any questions you have.
If you have questions for Dr. Howard, please stand up and speak loudly, because I don't see microphones unless I...
Thank you. Anybody? Yes, sir. Oh, the David, it's you. It's you, Dave. Surely. Well, I don't know the exact concentration in the crude that came out, that's coming up from the Macondo well. I do know that it was relatively sulfur-free in that respect. It's different, a different type of crude. But certainly, you know, as you take crude and you go into the production side, you know, downstream, and you put it into a refinery, you're going to refine it so that those heavy long aliphatic chains are going to drop to the bottom. You can make some wonderful asphalt out of it. But the gasoline fractions, and there are smarter people in the audience that could probably answer this to the percentage, but those larger fractions are going to be essentially octane, and all of those things are going to be what the shorter chains are going to be what is more concentrated in gasoline. And somebody here probably has the percentage in the top of their head.
Let me ask, you identified the lessons learned, and can the American people be certain that if we have such an incident again, that the lessons learned have been put in place? In other words,
Well, I certainly hope so. You know, at CDC, we're engaged in our lessons learned exercise now, trying to get everyone involved, anyone who participated, what were your observations, what lessons did you learn, and to produce a document. Certainly at NIOSH, we want to do a publication on our own lessons learned from the occupational side. We hope that OSHA will join us or do their own document. But certainly as we collect that information, because there were multiple federal agencies involved here, I think that's where we can make the progress in the future. So in terms of your question, I certainly hope that we can all be better assured that if we have this kind of an oil spill event, we're going to take all the lessons learned and we're going to do better with them. One product that we're working on together with, in collaboration with a number of federal and state agencies, which we were working on prior to the Deepwater Horizon event, that now has given us extra momentum and essentially a product from our lessons learned, is a model program for emergency response from the occupational or the worker side. So we hope to have that draft up on our website. People are writing furiously now. We hope to have that website up and that document downloadable for anyone interested by the holidays. Yes, ma'am. Yes, that's a very good question. For those of you who didn't hear it, is there something in the plan that would include 2.5 particulate exposure? We have a big section on exposure assessment in detail, but certainly, you know, measuring particulates, 2.5 or smaller, is a very important issue, very important issue. Yes, ma'am. That's a very good question. The question, if you didn't hear it, workers that were out there in the very earliest phases, are they included in the roster? What we did in order to capture them, because we had the same issue that you did, if we leave them out, obviously any recruitment coming out of our roster, there's inherent bias there. We drove around, and I don't say we, but NIOSH folks drove around to all of these staging areas to capture those folks. That involved, you know, going all over Louisiana and the Gulf Coast to find out where those folks were that had escaped through the training, that we hadn't rostered them. So that's the 16,000. Those represent folks that were rostered at a staging area or earliest time workers. The workers that then were rostered in the training centers essentially came on after that first 10-15 days. But we were out there, the event was on the 20th, we were out there that first weekend after, which was May 1st, 2nd. So not a whole lot of time went on. So I'm relatively certain that we captured those folks. But thank you for that question. Yes, sir. Well, that's a little beyond my, I think we're going to ask somebody from EPA, NOAA, or someone like that. I really am not capable of answering that one. Sorry. Yes, ma'am. Sure, and maybe some of our other panelists will address that. I just wanted to make one little comment about that. You know, here in the Department of Health and Human Services, we activated our medical side, and we actually put a clinic in the area. We actually got a lot of pushback from local providers who said, you know, your clinic is competing with our work here. We can take care of our own people. So we didn't expand that particular aspect and put more of those mobile clinics because the local health capabilities were just right there and capable of doing the job. And I think Dr. Williamson is going to comment on that.
All right.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Very fine presentation.